piece on post-secondary enrollment options program, and there are several other articles, maybe one other article on college affordability. And feel free, members, if there's something that you want to share with other members, be sure to let the staff know, and we'd be happy to distribute it, discuss it, whatever you like. And I know Senator Lynch had something the other day that we ran out of time to cover, so we'll have to. Did we cover that? No, we didn't. We didn't talk about it. So we'll get back to that at a later hearing. To give us a brief overview of PSEO and the an update on the P16 collaboration, Ms. Cindy Crist from the Office of the Chancellor. And Susan Henderson is going to come up too, I think. Start out.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Crist. I'm System Director for P16 Collaboration for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities in the Office of the Chancellor. I'm going to give you a very brief sort of a PSEO 101, just in case any of you are unfamiliar with this program, which, for whatever reason, is discussed more on the P-12 side of the legislature than higher ed, then give you a little bit of data, a little snapshot of PSEO enrollment and enrollment trends in our system. Very briefly, in response to some questions from staff, identify several issues and challenges, not try to describe them or solve them, but identify them for you. And then my colleague from the University of Minnesota, with whom I work on an almost daily basis, will take the next piece of this. So okay. Just to give you that little bit of background, post-secondary enrollment options program was established in 1985, and you do have a handout of this, by the way, if you want to follow along. We were the first state in the country to have a statewide dual credit program. And the term dual credit simply means that high school students can simultaneously earn high school and college credit for completing courses. They do it tuition-free. Statute limits participation to high school juniors and seniors. Statute also prohibits them, those students, from enrolling in developmental ed or remedial courses. So in this context, when we talk about providing tuition-free college-level learning, they are real college courses, but it's college-level as opposed to developmental level. The statute also allows both public and private post-secondary institutions to offer instruction as long as the courses are non-sectarian. The statute really puts in the hands of higher ed the authority to determine the basis upon which juniors and seniors will be admitted. And it's also very clear that we're to admit these students only on a space available basis. So we're supposed to give priority to our quote-unquote regular post-secondary students and admit post-secondary enrollment students then as there is space available. In the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, we have a policy and procedure that set those admission standards at the top third of the class or the top 30th percentile in a nationally standardized test for juniors, the top half of the class or top 50% in a nationally standardized test for seniors. Our policy and procedure do also allow for our colleges and universities to set other standards that basically ensure that a student can do the work. So there are some students or some courses or some cases in which other standards might be put in place if it's believed that the student can benefit. We also require these students, as we do all of our other students, to complete a college placement test before they can enroll in a course. So they're admitted on the basis of the standards that I just outlined. They may enroll after they've taken a course placement test so that we're sure that they have the skills, for example, to take a college-level math course.
Ms. Crist, have you always required that?
Madam Chair, yes, we have.
Madam Chair?
Senator Sharon.
Would you, I'm sorry, I'm trying to integrate what you just said, that, that the college placement test has to be completed before enrolling, but not necessarily before taking the courses?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, no, they have to take the test before they can enroll in courses, but not before they're admitted.
And is there a certain level of achievement they have to meet in that college?
Senator Sharon.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes. In our system, we have now a common cut score. So there's a specific score There are three sections on the placement test. It basically assesses reading skills, writing skills, and mathematical skills. And we've specified scores that are set system-wide for what scores students have to achieve on the reading test, for example, before they can take reading intensive courses. In statute, PSEO was initially limited to students taking courses on a college or university campus. But for a variety of reasons, as the course developed, the statute was amended to allow something called courses according to agreement. And this simply enables a college or university and a school district to enter into a contractual arrangement to provide PSEO courses to students. Those courses, according to statute, can be taught by either high school or college university faculty. They can be offered at a high school or other location. And what we've seen is that about two-thirds of the enrollment in our system, and I haven't seen the most recent data, but I believe about two-thirds of the enrollment statewide under the PSEO statute is in the form of courses according to agreement called concurrent enrollment. I know the terminology can be a little confusing. What's the difference between dual credit and concurrent enrollment or concurrent credit? And I suppose as far as the dictionary is concerned, there isn't any difference. But as we use those terms, dual credit is the broad umbrella term for courses that students take and get high school and college credit. Concurrent enrollment, we define, and it's most commonly defined nationally, as college courses that are offered to students in a high school, taught by a high school teacher who's approved by the college university to teach the course. The college university provides a faculty member to serve as a mentor or partner to work with that teacher to ensure that the teacher is delivering a real college course as it would be delivered on a campus, that student assignments are the same assignments they'd complete if they took the course on a campus, that they're taking the same assessments. And those teachers are also provided, those high school teachers, with orientation, with professional development. In our system, all 32 of our institutions enroll students in some form of PSEO. And just last year in our system, students enrolled in PSEO offered by our institutions came from 328 different districts across the state. So I'm not sure what the current count of districts is in Minnesota, but that's pretty close to all of them. I'm not going to talk about all of the data that I provided because you have it on your slides, but I thought you might be interested to know that 14,000, a little over 14,000 of the 21,655 students that we enroll in PSEO are enrolled at or through courses offered by two-year colleges, and 7,000 at state universities, so about two-thirds in two-year institutions. The majority of students are taking courses in Greater Minnesota, so it's used much more there, which may make a lot of sense given issues of proximity and opportunity and sizes of districts. Most of the courses in our system are contract-based courses. More females than males are enrolled. I don't have this on a handout, but one of the places where we have not been successful as we would like to be, and are undertaking some conversations with our P-12 colleagues and others about this, is that, frankly, the vast majority of students who participate in PSEO are white students. And we really would like to do much better at serving a more diverse student population through PSEO. We're not quite sure why more students of color are not participating, and that's something we'd very much like to change. Students who take courses, concurrent enrollment type courses, take far fewer credits than students who take courses on a college campus. Probably makes sense when you think about issues of travel, time, and distance. But students who take courses on campuses tend to take more credits. And also students in the metro area actually take more credits in Greater Minnesota. And again, that fits the pattern, I think, of full-time, part-time. And you have a chart in the handout that shows that online PSEO student headcount growth has been pretty significant. Starting at, I think it's 800 and some in 2004, to more like 2,300 now. So that's an area.
And didn't I hear that the completion rates for these high school students with the online course are comparable to the college students?
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. I have not looked at that data, but I believe that is correct. And then just to let you know, even though you're going to be hearing about a couple of examples within our system, that show that some of our concurrent enrollment and other PSEO arrangements are not all sort of traditionally academic, if you will. Still, the areas of greatest enrollment by discipline are in kind of those gen ed courses. So from English as the most popular down to history is also being fairly significant. So the last thing that I'll say before I turn the mic over to my colleague is that staff asked us to identify some issues and challenges. And I'll just identify them. We might want to wait and talk about them later. You may want to hear about some of the examples before you even dig into them. But just to let you know, there are a few that I hear about commonly. One is how we can be sure that students are informed about PSEO opportunities. And there are some challenges there. We're prohibited in statute. We, higher ed, are prohibited in statute from promoting PSEO on the basis of cost savings, but we're not prohibited from promoting it on the basis of what's available and the opportunities. I think some of our institutions are making some sort of renewed efforts to do that because they learn from parents and students that those students were not aware of PSEO opportunities.
Ms. Chris, you mean cost savings in terms of college cost savings?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
That seems like a big, significant thing for students.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't disagree with you.
So this is a prohibition that dates back to 1985?
Madam Chair, I don't believe it goes back that far, but it has been in the statute for some time.
Okay.
A second one is helping students and parents make appropriate choices of rigorous courses. People are paying more and more attention to AP, IB. There's the CLEP option also, and get ready, get credit. And so one of the challenges is helping students and parents understand those programs and identify the ones that are best for them. The biggest one that comes up, no matter who you talk to, I think, are the financial arrangements and costs. And I'm sure we could spend a whole hearing just talking about that. But what it costs to deliver it, what it costs to school districts to have students participate, continue to be major issues. Setting appropriate standards for student success without creating unnecessary barriers is also a challenge. You know, no standard is perfect. Just because you're in the top third of your class doesn't automatically mean you're going to be successful. So we continue to grapple with that and how we can collect data and look at it to be sure we're setting appropriate standards so that students who could benefit from PSEO have an opportunity to participate. Teacher credentials was an issue that you heard a lot about, I think, a couple of sessions ago. And we have worked hard in our system to address that, to ensure that the high school teachers teaching concurrent enrollment courses for us have good credentials and experiences without setting those standards in such a narrowly defined way that we don't allow students throughout the state to have opportunities to take concurrent enrollment.
Your teachers have to have a master's degree?
Madam Chair, that's the general standard, but there are options for teachers to be approved with something, I hate to say less than that, but something mm-hmm. other than that. Mm-hmm. It could be a combination of years of teaching experience, demonstrated excellence in teaching, and so on. And then finally, continuing to look for new models of delivering PSEO and making it available. And after Sue and I are finished, you'll hear from a couple of our programs about some of those new models. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Before Ms. Chris jumps away, thank you, Madam Chair. help me walk through the eligibility requirements here. So it's an either or. So you've got a class rank or a score on a national test. So one of those, and I know some high schools are getting away from class ranks now and not even calculating those. Okay, so if a student is eligible by class rank or by a standardized test, then there was one other piece that you talked about as necessary before starting the program.
Ms. Christ.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, yes. they're admitted based on either the class rank, the test score, or I mentioned there's a provision for other evidence. At some of our institutions, they partner with a high school and require GPA instead of class rank,
okay.
where they found that that's more effective. And then maybe the third piece that you were thinking about is not an admission standard, but before they can actually enroll in a course, they have to complete a college placement test.
Okay.
It demonstrates that they have the skills and knowledge, you know, that prepares them to do college-level work.
And
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the timing of that college placement test convenient, or do we have juniors and seniors that want to do PSEO, but they've got to wait until they take this test and you guys see the results? I'm just trying to see if there's a timing issue.
Ms. Chris, do they take it in 10th grade?
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, timing is a little bit of a challenge. It's not a challenge the way it would be for the ACT, because our colleges and universities, most or all of them, have test centers. So it's not difficult for them to arrange for a student to take the test when the student needs to take it. But we are discovering, Madam Chair, you asked if this had always been a requirement that students
do the placement test. Yeah.
Technically, it has been, but not all of our institutions had understood our course placement policy to apply to PSEO students. So some of our institutions have not, they've been using other data to be sure that students were ready to do college-level courses. We've clarified that in our procedure, and actually starting next fall, all of our institutions will be in compliance with that. What we're hearing from some of the schools that partner with colleges and universities who had not been giving the placement test is that they're trying to make sense of the timing of this, because if you're going to go to a state university in our system, you may apply, you know, in the fall of your senior year and be admitted. You don't really need to take a placement test or present a placement score until much closer to the time you actually show up at the college university. With PSEO students, the timing of those two events is much closer. In other words, a student may apply to participate in PSEO and almost at the same time be seeking to be admitted to a particular course. So that's one of the reasons that when we clarified this requirement in our procedure, we made it effective next fall so that we could give partnering colleges, universities, and high schools the time to figure out how they can make the timing work so that we're doing what we feel we need to do to ensure that students can be successful, as much as you can ever ensure it, but we're not disadvantaging students and making it difficult for high schools to manage their scheduling and so on because of the timing of the placement test.
So you actually bring up an issue, which I hope Ms. Henderson will address as well, is what about the idea of allowing sophomores and even freshmen to take PSEO courses?
Madam Chair, I was just discussing that with one of my P-12 colleagues from whom you'll be hearing shortly. And I think we all recognize that there are probably some, a few ninth graders who might be ready to take college-level courses. We would want to be very cautious about, opening that door. Students fail these courses, they're failing to get the credit they need to graduate from high school, as well as failing to get the college credit that they would like to get. So I think if there's going to be consideration of including grades below 11th grade in PSEO, I think we'll need to look at that very carefully to be sure that we're not setting students up for failure, when what we're trying to do is give them new opportunities for success.
Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe 2 years ago our Education Policy Committee had a variety of hearings around the state. We were in Senator Erickson Ropes' district, and some of the high school teachers talked about the rigorous intent of PSEO and questioned why students could take guitar, various human performance courses, which in and of themselves I'm sure are very good and needed, but if the intent was on some of the traditional math and science, foreign language requirements, is this a concern? They thought it was money that could be spent more wisely, and I don't know how widespread that would be, but they had talked about guitar courses and yoga. And again, I'm not disputing why that's good, but teachers.
Some people think we all should be taking yoga, that we'd be all much healthier and calmer. We all did that.
And again, Madam Chair, I'm not disputing that, but to leave your high school.
Just watch your tongue around yoga. The chairwoman takes yoga.
It's a good committee hearing, Madam Chair.
It'll be mandated then. Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Wigger, I would respond to that in two ways. One is that the statute says that the purpose of the section is to promote rigorous academic pursuits and to provide a wider variety of options to high school pupils. I've always read that to be two things that were not necessarily exclusive, but not necessarily identical. And my personal opinion is that since students still have to meet all of their graduation requirements in the high school, I'm not sure if it's problematic for them to be taking, you know, pursuing sort of an athletically oriented course, if you will, a physical education course or a music course or some other course on a college university campus. If it's impeding their progress toward high school graduation, clearly it would be an issue. If it's not, and the student can manage everything else in their schedule and it gives them an opportunity to pursue something of particular interest in them on their part that keeps them engaged in education, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily a problem.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just relaying what teachers, what their testimony was. And there seems to be a bit of a tension between K-12 and higher ed teachers and in terms of where the revenue goes.
Senator Wigger, though, if you look at the statistics on page 5, mm-hmm. that since most students are taking academic subjects, it sounds like those are really exceptional, those other courses.
Okay, Madam Chair, and I'll note that to Senator Ropes and any Erickson Ropes and others, and where the question's raised, and we'll.
And her ears must be burning because she should be here.
Yeah. Follow up.
Yeah, Madam please.
Chair, and Ms. Chris, is there any evaluations that you've done with counselors on the program regarding the their conclusions regarding the effectiveness of the program and recommendations?
Ms. Kristen, hopefully Ms. Henderson will answer that.
Madam Chair, Senator Wigger, some of our institutions may have talked to counselors. Of course, as I'm sure you know, high school counselors are few and far between in Minnesota. So unfortunately, there aren't a lot of them with whom to speak.
But they are in statute, Madam Chair, to be a part of this process.
Hasn't Joe Nathan done a study of PSEO? It seems to me I saw it a few years ago.
Madam Chair, I think he has. I don't know if this is one of the issues that he addressed, but
we can look
key issue is that, you know, it's really critical that the college, university, and a high school have a close working relationship so that as issues arise, they can address them. And I think our institutions work hard to do that, and P12 partners are very willing to do that. So communication is very important, clearly.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Chris, you agree with the concept. I was just wondering, is there evidence to back that up? And so if there is anything, that would be helpful.
Okay, Ms. Henderson.
Thank you. I'm Susan Henderson. I'm Director of Pre-College Programs in the College of Continuing Education at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. You'll see there's a significant difference about how the University of Minnesota and MinSCU works, namely that we do not have a centralized person or position overseeing all of the PSEO programs in the university system. I will give you a quick overview because I have talked with my colleagues in Crookston and Duluth and Morris. So, first, quick overview. The numbers I think, much smaller. Morris, for example, has in 07-08, 30 on-campus PSEO students. Crookston had 39. Duluth had 45. And the Twin Cities had about 550. So then you have to go back and add on the PSEO online students, and that will bring the numbers up. Crookston, for example, in 08-09 for this current year has 98 individual students registered. That PSEO online is growing quite significantly. The Twin Cities program also in PSEO has students online, and that is growing as well. Last year it was between 40 to 50 students, and this year it's about 60 or 70, so that's increasing. Also, all of the programs, all the PSEO, all the college and the schools operate independently of each other. So the student qualifications are different from campus to campus. I think the Twin Cities campus is unique because it does a holistic review. It does not have a stipulated GPA, or there are no test requirements by and large. So the Duluth and Morris and Crookston all require GPAs of 3.0 or better. The Twin Cities program, as I said, does not have a GPA requirement. The applications are reviewed holistically, and when it's all done and over, we can look and see that the average GPA of students accepted into the Twin Cities PSEO program is 3.8 or better. So it's quite competitive. We do not, as a rule, use placement tests, but and again, now I'm speaking specifically about the Twin Cities program. The PSEO students receive intensive advising from advisors in our office about which courses make sense, which courses they're ready for, and this is after a review of their high school transcripts. You asked about essentially sort of what measure do we know whether the PSEO students are successful. So we know that each year there are 15 or fewer students on the Twin Cities campus who we dismiss from the program because they have not performed academically. So that would be 15 or fewer out of almost 600. College in the schools is also on each of these campuses, and that tends to be on each campus, except for Morris. It tends to have higher participation. Crookston has a little over 1,100 unduplicated headcount in their college in the schools. Duluth has just about 1,000. Morris has just begun working with, has just started a college in the schools program, and they are working with one or two local high schools. I don't know what the numbers are, but it would be very small. The Twin Cities has a very large college in the schools program and serves schools and students who are from the Twin Cities, but also outside the Twin Cities. So in 07-08, CIS and the Twin Cities served little over 4,500 individual students. We're currently working with 100 different high schools. The average credit load, I think, reflects what Cindy's already mentioned. The PSEO student tends to take more credits than the college in the schools student. So on the Twin Cities campus, on the Duluth campus, PSEO students take 9.7 credit hours, and the college and the schools take more like 6.3.
That's credit. Over their entire high school career, over their junior and senior years?
That's for 1 year.
That's just in 1 year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and as far as success goes, when we're looking at college and the schools, again, the evaluation processes differ slightly from campus to campus, but three of the University of Minnesota college and the schools programs, are accredited by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships. And that accreditation, to achieve that accreditation and to keep it, you are required to do program evaluations some on a yearly basis, some every 5 years. So we do have data that tells us how our students are doing.
Can I just clarify that when you're talking about credits, are these usually 3-credit courses?
3 and 4. Lots of them are 4.
Oh, okay. So it could be 9 credits, could be 3 courses, or it could be 2 courses. Yeah, okay.
Okay, I would like now to leave the sort of numbers on overview and talk about one of the questions that we know that the committee's interested in, and that is, what are the benefits of participation in PSEO? Reminding you that there are at least 2 kinds of PSEO, the traditional on-campus, and then the kind that happens in the high school, which is most often the concurrent enrollment or the PSEO, where the university course is taught by a prepared and supported high school instructor. For both kinds of PSEO, there are terrific benefits. The students earn transcripted credits that transfer, not just here in the state of Minnesota, but outside of Minnesota. Or another way of thinking about it is that these credits are recognized. And I want to clarify that the credits being recognized can mean one of 3 things. It can mean that those credits are applied towards graduation credit. It can mean that a student is exempted from a required course at, you know, another university. It can also mean that a student is placed in an advanced course because they've already taken the physics introduction course and they're ready for a more advanced course. So this gives students what one of the preeminent education analysts, Cliff Edelman, calls academic momentum. And you can see in the handout with the multicolored sheets of paper that I provided, on the yellow sheet, I believe it's on the, it's study 3 that is highlighted here, the toolbox revisited. Edelman says that students that enter high school or enter higher education with a minimum of 6 additive credits helps them cross this sort of magic 20-credit line. He says if you don't have 20 credits by the end of the first year, your prospects from graduating from college are not so good. So he says 6 is good, 9, going back, 6 credits is good, 9 credits is better, and 12 is a guarantee of momentum. So one of the most important things PSEO on both forms can do is provide that momentum.
Wouldn't you need to have 30 credits by the end of your first year, though, to really graduate within 4 years?
Yes, I believe you would, but this was a national survey where Dr. Edelman reviewed transcripts and the patterns that he saw.
If you had at least 20, then you were more likely to be on track.
Right.
Okay.
Another benefit to students is they've had firsthand experience with the higher academic standards, with the increased personal responsibility for their own learning that higher ed requires. And it gives them, they're a little more savvy about what it means to go to college, and that serves them well. Makes a better transition. They also are more likely to graduate in 4 years or in what, not necessarily 4 years, but whatever the expected graduation time is. So if it's a 2-year college, 2 years and so on. Those students have greater flexibility in their academic schedules when they do become full-time college students. Because they've come with some of the basic requirements already met, so they can do internships or study abroad, do double majors, whatever. So those are all benefits that both kinds of PSEO have. Therefore, when you look at concurrent enrollment, there are benefits that extend to both the teachers who participate and to the schools. You can't do concurrent enrollment without having ongoing support coming from the university to the teachers. So in the Twin Cities College and the Schools campus, we have a minimum of 3 full days of professional development that is in, it's discipline specific, it's university based, and it goes on for as long as they're teaching for the university. In the MNSCU system, they teachers work with mentors and university faculty, and that's on an ongoing basis. So professional development is part of the package.
So a side benefit is for those teachers, they're probably also teaching standard high school classes. So they're bringing additional skills and expertise to those other classes as well, I would imagine.
Exactly. We hear that all the time. And if they're teaching in a field where there are a lot of sequential courses like language or math, once the teachers find out, they're working with the university or the college folks, they find out what students need to know and be able to do to succeed when they take this university course, they go right back to their own high school academic departments and say, hey, we've got to change our curriculum so our students will be prepared to succeed. The concurrent enrollment also benefits schools, too, by allowing those great students, those high-achieving students, to stay on-site at the high school and participate in all of the high school life and contribute their own high standards. I want to take a minute also to, a couple of minutes, to look at the differences. This is another question that we received, the differences between dual enrollments and other accelerated learning options. And you can see on the salmon handout, this is probably the single most popular document I've ever created. And I'd like to point out again that this salmon colored is about the University of Minnesota Twin Cities program, but alone, that's what it's based on. But much of what is highlighted here would be could easily be applied to other programs. First, as Cindy mentioned, the PSEO allows a wider range of courses to be offered. So you can have the career and technical courses. You can have anatomy and physiology or animal science, which you can't get through AP or IB. Another key difference, dual enrollment. Both kinds of dual enrollment allow students to earn their grade and their credit through multiple and varied assessments. And this works really well for students who are phobic about tests. It also makes the course, I think, less vulnerable to teaching to the test. And it's what you're going to find when you come to college, because it is college. I want to clarify, too, another important difference is not always understood, and that's how accountability happens in the various forms of accelerated learning. Advanced placement, and I want to be clear, too, these are all good programs that serve students in important ways. But it's good to understand some of the differences. AP relies on a review of the syllabus at their national office. Each teacher's required to now, this is very recent change, to submit their syllabus to the AP office for review. They are encouraged to use a curriculum that's described by AP in texts that are described, but they're not required. And then the real measurement of the quality comes in a nationally normed exam that all students take. Teacher prep workshops are recommended, but not required. IB relies, in order to be accountable and to ensure quality, IB relies on a required curriculum, externally scored exams, and a few required teacher training workshops. Both kinds of dual enrollment rely on or use post-secondary institutional practices and policies to guarantee quality. When you are talking about the PSEO in the high school or the concurrent enrollment, like college in the schools, the accreditation by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships that I mentioned is an excellent measurement and public statement of quality. That each program that seeks to be accredited by NACEP must demonstrate that it meets or exceeds standards in several areas, including faculty and curriculum and how students are handled and program evaluation and student assessment. So it's AP. AP score can tell you that all students who earned a score of 4 achieved at the same level. NACEP accreditation doesn't make a statement about that's true nationally, but it does say that the courses taught in the high school are the same as those taught on the college campus. In point D on this, on the handout, actually it's at the back, I think, of your package. There's quite a difference between what the costs are to schools among the traditional PSEO, PSEO in the high school, AP, and IB. I'm not going to go over that in detail. I don't want to take up too much time, but you'll see that, and this is part of the tension, I think, with traditional PSEO between high schools and colleges. The high schools for traditional PSEO lose a portion of their per-student allotment when a student goes to a college campus. PSEO in the high schools, or college in the schools, every program charges a fee, and schools have to come up with that. I think one of the biggest differences is the extent to which the state of Minnesota has subsidized AP and IB and concurrent enrollment. You may know that last biennium was the first time that concurrent enrollment received any state subsidy. AP and IB, it varies from year to year, but they have for some time received assistance. Those dollars that go out, the dollars that are invested in PSEO as opposed to AP and IB, those dollars stay here in Minnesota instead of going to the College Board or to the IB organization.
Ms. Henderson, I need to have you wrap up because you're actually coming back on my agenda later.
Yeah, and that's all I had.
Okay, any questions about the College and the Schools program? You don't have to ask a question, Senator Weaker.
I'll wait another time.
All right. Thank you very much. Next, we're going to move on to two MinSCU initiatives, Discovery Academy, Sandra Fabian, is she here? And Brenda Steve from Sartell, principal at Sartell. Would you both come up? Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the tape and the committee, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandy Fabian. I'm the Associate Dean at St. Cloud Technical College and in charge of academic and innovative partnerships. And one of my initiatives that I'm responsible for is Discovery Academy, and that's what I'm going to share a little bit with you today. My colleague.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brenda Steve, and I'm the principal at Sartell High School, and we partner with the St. Cloud Technical College with Discovery Academy.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. You should have, I think they're being handed out right now, some shots of PowerPoint slides that I put together for you, as well as a brochure that we make available in the counseling offices at our various partner schools. And then another handout that's in white that Mrs. Steve brought with her relative to her comments today. So in light of the fact that we have a limited amount of time, I won't share all comment on all of the slides that you have in front of you, but I will talk about just a few of them. First of all, I wanted to start out with just in very briefly the concept that Discovery Academy is built upon. This initiative initiated first out of area high schools coming to the college and asking how we could partner in order to expand or retain high-quality career and technical courses at the high school level. So we started with that premise in mind and then built from there as to how we could do that because it's different than academic courses. So we offer technical courses in the high school, in high schools that are interested and have the appropriate resources, and I'll talk a little bit about those resources a little bit later. The second bullet on the concept is something that I wanted to share with you as well, in that in our local community of St. Cloud, Sartell, and Sauk Rapids, we do have and have had in the past students moving between the buildings, between the school districts, in order to take classes that are offered in one district but not another, because, again, the resources are usually pretty extensive. So that has worked out quite well for us and, again, allows us to offer courses that otherwise couldn't be available. Our faculty review if we have interested school districts that are interested in particular courses that we offer. Generally, I make the first visit and then bring the faculty out to look at the labs, to visit with the faculty at the high school level to see, if they're able to offer at the level, at the college level, able to offer the courses. We do have, the courses are transcripted for the St. Cloud Technical College, and we do partner in many ways. We partner with, through our foundation, we're able to partner offering supplies, materials, training, and other kinds of materials that are necessary in order to offer the technical courses. The next couple of slides show you that this is one of the questions, that the partner schools that we have. We currently partner with seven different schools in our regional area. And just this week, I got a couple of other calls from neighboring schools, so that list does grow, usually one or two each year. We offer 23 different courses. And the disciplines are listed there. They are all technical courses in nature, automotive, computer networking and programming, emergency medical services, carpentry, and welding. And the next slide shows you a little bit more detail on the amounts of credits and that kind of thing in each of those discipline areas. The process that we use is similar to what was mentioned earlier, in that it's PSEO by contract, so we have contracts with our various school districts that we partner with, and we either have a mentoring fee or the students pay tuition. We do, most of our courses are offered as mentored courses, in that the high school teachers are mentored by one of the college faculty. However, we do have a couple of instances where the particular high schools wanted courses or the courses were needed to be offered relative to areas where there was not an appropriately trained person at the high school level, a teacher able to teach what we wanted to offer. So in that case, we do have college teachers that are placed in the high schools teaching specifically those courses.
Ms. Fabian, do you think that this request from the high school was result of the decline in vocational technical classes available at the high school level?
Yeah, initially this first conversation came up probably 7 years ago or so, when they began to see a decline an increase in the cost of keeping up those kinds of labs and coursework. There was one school that came to us, they were having some people retire and knowing that it was going to be hard to find appropriately trained teachers. Mm-hmm. And also the industry is changing so much, and these kinds of courses, in order to really give students a view of how this would really look out in industry, you have to have labs that are pretty high end. So those kinds of things gave this impetus.
Thank you.
So some of these things have already been covered about, you know, the accountability and how students apply to our campus. There's an application process. The counselors give us information about their academic progress and sign that they have the ability to benefit. We have an online and a in-person orientation that is mandatory for students and parents. We send out, you know, we're in contact with the students from the time that they apply. We do have, I added a slide here that demonstrates the kind of rigor that we have in our courses. Wherever it is possible, we are at industry standard. So our curriculum is based on industry standard. Our assessments are based on industry standard. In the automotive area, that AYES is an assessment. And in the computer area, Cisco, which you might be familiar with that terminology. In EMS, again, that's a health industry standard. And engineering classes that we offer, engineering and manufacturing, that is Project Lead the Way certified in all of our sites. So the rigor is coming from the industry in whatever discipline we're talking about. And I gave you a couple of larger slides behind the last two sheets that you have so that you could see these, because otherwise the slides are kind of small. There was question about what we see for usage. So I put together a couple of table bar graphs that would help to demonstrate that. We currently are in our sixth year of offering courses in this way. And so what you see here is by year, from fiscal year 04 through now. The first bar is the amount of enrollment in a given year. The second bar would be the credit usage at our college, and that's really all I have access to. Anything else would be anecdotal as far as them using it. And then the third bar is the available seniors in that given year. So overall, as you look at this, we're seeing about 56% of the available seniors in a given year coming to our college using that credit. So it is being used. And anecdotally, we do evaluations with students and hear that they are planning to go on to college and use the credit. The second table shows you the usage at St. Cloud Technical College and persistence in the pathway. And the reason I pulled that out is because what we are helping students do is explore career pathways in the areas that I mentioned, automotive, welding, carpentry, and so on. So we wanted to see if there's a correlation between what the courses that they take in high school to help them begin to explore that area, and are they staying in that same pathway when they come to our campus. And these tables show you overall that we see 66% of the students that come to our campus are persistent in that pathway. And Mrs. Steve is going to tell you a little bit about the high school experience.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we partner with three different institutions, St. Cloud State University, Southwest State University, to offer the traditional, what I would call traditional concurrent enrollment courses in six different subject areas: math, science, English, art, social studies, world language, and speech. And we've been part of that program for a number of years. When Ms. Fabian called us and asked us to be part of the Discovery Academy program, we were very excited because it does open the world of post-secondary options for all of the students at our high school. And we currently partner with Discovery Academy. We have students that take courses in all of the areas that Discovery Academy offers. In particular, we offer two different Project Lead the Way courses at our high school: Introduction to Engineering Design, which is a very rigorous engineering course, followed up by Principles of Engineering, also very rigorous, very hands-on. And then we also offer at our high school Emergency Medical Services.
Do those fulfill the science requirements then for the grad rule?
Madam Chair, at our high school it does not do that. In fact, it's advantageous if students can have at our high school, we require 3 credits of science to graduate per legislation, and it's advantageous for students to take Introduction to Engineering Design or Principles of Engineering after having some of that science background and math as well. Okay. So it's really to their advantage.
It's
to
more
wait.
Of an advanced course.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. We also offer at our high school Emergency Medical Services, and because we're in close proximity with other local high schools, Our students can also travel to another high school to take the automotive program and the computer program as well. And we have students that take advantage of that all the time. And we have students coming to our high school from other local high schools to take the Project Lead the Way courses and the Emergency Medical Services course at our high school also. The benefits that we've seen at our high school, obviously students can earn college credit while they're in high school. That's a no-brainer, sort of. But the big thing that it's done for us is increased rigor in two different ways. The courses that we offer through the partnerships with the three different institutions that we work with have been, it's the heart of what we do at our high school. And not just the courses for 11th and 12th graders, but when we talk to our incoming 9th grade parents, we encourage them to encourage their children to think about taking these options while they're at our high school. So what it's done really is it has put more rigor, not just at the 11th and 12th grade level, but also in our 9th and 10th grade levels as we seek to prepare them for those courses. And it's been just, if it went away, it would take away the identity that we have at our high school. You've heard this before, but I can speak from working in the program, teaching in the program, and then also from the teachers that work at our high school. The partnerships and the mentoring that happens with the college professor is a type of professional development that that's invaluable to us. The teaching is better, and the teaching that happens in the 9th and 10th grade levels by these same teachers who are teaching college level courses is better, and the rigor is higher. What Discovery Academy in particular has done for our students, Ms. Fabian and her colleagues at the Technical College have worked with business and industry, and our students are able during the course of semester to get out into industry and actually practice engineering at their site. Some of the prototypes that they develop in our classroom, they actually take over to industry and they make whatever it was that they designed. And that experience has just been fantastic for our students. So it's just a tremendous program. We hope to expand the Project Lead the Way courses, our engineering courses. Our emergency medical services courses are growing. Every year we see more and more students who enroll in these programs. And because we partner with two universities and the technical college, it brings concurrent enrollment possibilities for every student in our high school.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you, and thank you for coming down from St. Cloud and Sartell. We appreciate you hearing about your program.
Madam Chair, I have one little question.
Senator Tomasoni.
We were talking in Senator Metzen's committee about the lack of vocational programs in our high schools, and looks like this is kind of a bridge that is working pretty well. How is it fitting in with the high school standards that we're having, where they're having to take the math and the science and all the rest of the stuff and all the test taking, and are we able to get through all that and get kids graduating? And has this had a positive effect on the kids? Because it's kind of some people's contention that that these lack of vocational programs in our schools are actually causing us to lose some kids who would normally go into those programs. And do you have any comment on that?
Principal Steve.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, we teach, our schedule is a four-period day. We're on a four-period block, so our students can actually take eight classes in a year or eight credits in a year, and as a result, we've not seen that as a challenge. In fact, I think that the concurrent enrollment program, and especially the Discovery Academy program, has caused all students to raise their level of rigor, and the Project Lead the Way classes, Emergency Medical Service, Cisco, the automotive, all require that you can read, write, and do mathematics in order to be successful in them. It is a challenge at some high schools, though, I will tell you, to be able to fit the requirements that are out there and the testing and be able to offer enough electives. We're in a unique situation with our schedule to be able to do that.
So, and I'll reiterate that in that working with some other buildings who have different schedules. Shorter class periods, or more hours in the day, they do have a more difficult time getting in electives. So that can be a challenge for students who would like to make some of these choices but aren't able to because of the requirements.
Are any of these courses offered in the evenings?
No, not at this point.
Okay.
And Madam
Interesting
Chair,
idea.
Madam Chair, and why is it that you have this flexibility and other schools don't? I understand. I heard the four-course thing, but...
Because Ms. Steve.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have a different schedule. In 1983, we moved into our high school, and we made a conscious decision. Our Board of Education was supportive of this at the time, to go to a schedule in which we have four classes per day of 87 minutes. So what we don't have any study halls. So students can actually take a year-long course in a semester. So it's shorter. And so students can actually take 8 year-long courses in a year instead of in some schedules they can take 5. So our students, because our board has been supportive of that type of schedule, our students are exposed to more opportunities. And there are some high schools with the budget challenges that they have that aren't able to do that.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Steve, could you complete this sentence?
I hope so.
Each student in Minnesota by their junior year shall be eligible for at least one post-secondary credited program, except.
Is that exception to the student or exception to the program?
Yeah, any exception to the program.
He meant yoga.
I don't understand what he's saying.
We have a limited amount of students now, Madam Chair, that can participate in the post-secondary programs. Uh-huh. I believe the governor and many others, including Arkansas, have said all students will have an opportunity for post-secondary opportunities in high school. And it's wonderful what you're doing. I'm wondering, and earlier we had testimony that it's mostly whites that participate in these programs, and you know, I'm happy with the progress, but I wish every student could participate by their junior year, and why can't we statutorily say that? And that's what I pose as whether that's realistic, and if not, how what exception might there be?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, I would answer that. How would I answer that? When ninth grade students come into our high school, one of the things that we encourage all of our students, 100% of them, is to think about post-secondary education after high school. I think that is realistic. There are many challenges that high school students face as they just because of the age and the changes that happen. There certainly may be some high school juniors that are not ready for a post-secondary experience as a junior, but they may be as a senior, and perhaps not as a senior, but hopefully they will be once they're done with high school. And I think it's very realistic that all students are ready for a post-secondary experience when they complete high school. But as I said, there's some students that come with a lot of issues and a lot of challenges and need to work through those challenges before they might be ready for a post-secondary experience in the high school.
Okay. Thank you both very much. We're going to move on to the online college and the schools. Jill Abbott and Inger Wegener. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Abbott. I'm an Associate Dean of Academic and Student Services at Minnesota State Community and Technical College, and I'm the post-secondary manager of the Online College and the High School program. Online College and the High School started in 2005 with 13 schools, primarily in Northwest Minnesota. Today, we serve 30 districts, from as far north as Oakley to as far south as Morgan, Minnesota, Cedar Mountain High School. In the fall of 2005, the program started with 43 student registrations. Today, for the spring 2009 term, we have 190 student registrations and an unduplicated student headcount of 148 students participating. The program provides eligible high school students with access to college-level online courses taught by college faculty who are experienced in the online learning environment. Courses are delivered through the Desire to Learn, or D2L, course platform. The students remain in the high school setting for their high school and college courses, and they receive a unique complement of academic and student support services from the colleges, our secondary partners, and an online support center from the Office of the Chancellor. It's actually located in Perham, Minnesota, so geographically it's situated very nicely for this program. While the students do have time to work on their online courses during the high school day, and our partners tell us that that is a benefit of the program, we stress to them that they will be spending many, many hours outside of the high school day in order to be successful in their online courses. Online college in the high school does expose the students to the realities of that anytime, anywhere learning. And for many students, that means that they may be working on their online course at 10:30 at night or at 3 o'clock on Sundays when perhaps they would prefer to be doing other things. The expectations are very intense. And again, I want to stress that the content of the courses, when the students log in to their online college in the high school section, they are seeing the same course content that the students who are taking online courses in our regular college population are seeing. So it's the exact same content and rigor. The program has several unique features, including contracted tuition rates, dual transcription, and exclusive sections to online college and the high school students. We do not mix the online college and the high school population with the regular online college population, which differentiates this program from some of the other programs that are available. We've done that for a couple of reasons, but primarily our secondary partners have encouraged us to do that and have said that that's one of the things that they value about the program is the way we've designed it to create really an online learning community for online college and high school. We also, through our high school partners, they provide an on-site proctor at each school. The program has a group text-by service, and we have an online customized application and registration process. Students have access to technical support at night and on the weekends through an online support center located in Perham, Minnesota. Really, the collaboration of all of those partners, secondary, post-secondary, the online support center staff, I think has allowed the program to leverage resources to better meet student needs and to help keep the costs within reach of the high schools. You do have a handout that details the course descriptions that will be offered in the fall of 2009 and spring of 2010.
We were very curious about how you can do an online course on public speaking.
Yes, Madam Chair, excellent question. Actually, what happens is the instructor provides very detailed instructions and expectations about the speech and what type of speech it is. The students learn the different types of public speaking before they do their first speech. They have to secure an audience of at least 10 members where they actually perform their speech. They have to tape the speech, and then the content of that speech is uploaded into the course content. The instructor views the speech and critiques the speech.
So it's videotaped.
It's videotaped. In order to be eligible for online college in the high school, we use the GPA standard. So a junior student has to have a GPA of 3.2, and a senior student has to have a GPA of 2.8. And then they have to achieve a college-level score on that ACCUPLACER test. The ACCUPLACER test can be taken online at the student's high school. They don't have to travel anywhere to take that test. and it can be proctored by a high school staff member.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I was just wondering, is the fee covered by the district to take the Accuplacer test, or is there a student fee?
Ms. Abbott.
Madam Chair, Senator, the college covers the cost of the Accuplacer test for all of our students. All partners advise the students about the rigor of the courses and the unique nature of the online learning environment. Having taken several courses online, I know firsthand that it requires students to be very persistent, very independent, very self-directed as a learner. And so we work with our partners to make sure that they advise students about what they're getting into. For the majority of the students, online college in the high school is their first exposure to online credit-based learning. So we want to make sure it's a positive experience. We do...
Why don't you complete your sentence?
We do track and publish student achievement data each term. And for the fall, term that just wrapped up, 95.5% of the students earned a grade of A, B, or C in their online coursework.
Senator Weaker.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I had a question, too, on the transfer of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And for the biology courses, there's not a lab component. And if you're, let's say you're in the Minscu system then or others, usually you're going to have a lab component to meet the natural science. And you wouldn't just enroll for a lab then later. Could you help me on that?
Go ahead. Yes. Please proceed.
Senator, most students can pick up a one-credit lab if they have to at another college or university, but that could be something that they would have to pick up that lab credit at a later time. The lecture credits would transfer in the Minnesota transfer curriculum under the goal area of the sending institution.
Are there other questions?
No, sure.
Senator Roebling.
Now, could someone who is in a high school diploma program sign up for these courses if they were kind of non-traditional students but enrolled in a high school diploma program?
Is it Jill that would like to respond to this?
Senator.
Jill Abbott, please.
I'm not sure I understand the question. If
Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, we have the GED program, but some places offer, or they used to, maybe they don't anymore, a high school diploma program, which is more for students who have dropped out of school, but they want to get a diploma and not a GED certificate, and so they go and enroll in these programs. It just seems like a real perfect fit for students like that. Because they would get high school credit for it also. Is it a dual?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they could get both. I mean, they might be young adults or even older adults who quit school for whatever reason and are not trying to get their high school diploma.
Ms. Abbott.
Senator, I'm not certain. I want to make sure I'm answering your question correctly. I think if the student would be considered a high school student in Minnesota, this program, they may be eligible to be enrolled through this program. If not, we would have other programs at our college where we could serve that type of student. So, in order to be certain, I'd like to check on that a little bit more. Thank you. In addition to tracking student achievement data, we also conduct online surveys with our students each term. And I just want to share a couple of comments from the students to give you a sense of how they think they benefit from the program. One student said, it gives me insight into what college will be like next year. Another student commented, the credits transfer with an exclamation point. And then another student said, it really challenges myself to prepare for the future. We analyze the student achievement data each term and the student comments and use that information in our continuous improvement processes. Online College in the High School has received tangible and in-kind support from from the Learning Innovations Council, the Office of the Chancellor, the Department of Education, and the ACHIEVE program. And I just want to talk a little bit about how that support has helped the program. We've used it to expand some of our offerings, particularly in the science and math arenas, and that's something we're very committed to. It's also helped us offset specialized material and equipment costs for the high schools. The question about the speech class, Madam Chair, one of the things that we did for the participating high schools is purchase some flip cameras that they could use just to make sure that all students in the program had access to the same level of technology for their speeches. It's also enabled us to outreach to new districts who have expressed interest in the program. Most important, that support has helped us establish a course support fund. So even if a course does not fill to the max class size at a college, we can offer that course for the students and the high schools who are interested in. This is really critical for the high schools because they have to plan those student schedules in advance. It's also critical for them as they do their budgeting for the following year. So we appreciate that support, and we really recognize that online college in the high school counts on a broad array of advocates and supporters. Online college in the high school for me has been a really labor of love. It's a very small part of what I do, but it connects me with my secondary partners and students in the high schools, and it allows the students to prepare for a way of learning that I think they are going to encounter in the colleges and workplaces of the future.
Thank you. Ms. Abbott, did the idea of doing online courses in Minsku, did that kind of originate at the state, the technical college? Or do you know where it kind of came about?
Yes, Madam Chair. The idea for the online college in the high school program came to us as a request from Ms. Wegner and some of her colleagues who saw a need in their districts for online college courses for their schools.
And what college are you with?
Minnesota State Community and Technical College. We have campuses in Fergus Falls, Moorhead, Detroit Lakes, and Wadena, and okay. An online.
Oh, great. Okay. Okay, Ms. Wegner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Inger Wegener, and I work as a career and technical education specialist at Lakes Country Service Cooperative in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. At Lakes Country Service Cooperative, I am employed to serve a group of 29 member districts in a 7-county area. This is a large rural service area. To provide some perspective, the 7 counties served are Becker, Clay, Grant, Otter Tail, Stevens, Traverse, and Wilkin counties. The combined square miles of these counties is 6,769 miles, with an average of 21 people per square mile, whereas the Minnesota state average is 61 people per square mile. The smallest district I serve has a high school enrollment that averages 8 students per grade level, although 20 to 50 students per grade level is more common. Only 4 of the 7 counties contain a higher education institution. 3 of those are Minsku institutions, and 1 of them is a University of Minnesota institution. Online college in the high school started in the fall of 2005 as a pilot to serve the needs of these smaller, rural, geographically dispersed high schools who wanted to provide a rigorous college-level curriculum but did not have large enough numbers to marshal a section of concurrent enrollment, or where land-based PSEO was not a feasible option due to the distance to a campus and the travel time required. In addition, their students wanted access to a diverse array of college-level courses without having to leave their high school setting. The program is managed through a collaborative steering committee of 5 secondary distance learning coordinators, formerly known as tech prep coordinators, and an administrative representative from each of the college course providers, Currently, those colleges are Minnesota State Community and Technical College, Alexandria Technical College, and Northland Community and Technical College. The introduction to and marketing of online college in the high school to high schools is conducted by the secondary distance learning coordinators. With a history of service provision to the high schools through the federal Carl D. Perkins Career and Technical Education Act, these coordinators are often aware not only of the present level of secondary to post-secondary opportunities available, they frequently assist districts in continuous program improvement initiatives. Through this service relationship, online college in the high school can be introduced as an educational programming option that is customized to the district needs and to the interests of the students. Courses offered this current term of spring 2009 include Anatomy and Physiology 2, Principles of Nutrition, Medical Terminology, Introduction to Statistics, Principles of Marketing, Developmental Psychology, Social Problems, and Introduction to Public Speaking. Three of those courses are offering second sections, and a complete list of course offerings for the fall 09 and spring 10 semesters has been included in your packet of handouts. Online college in the high school offers both career and technical education and general education courses that are part of the Minnesota Transfer curriculum. Our course offerings are determined after analyzing a number of factors, including expressed interest from partner high schools, courses that apply to high-demand, high-skill career pathways, courses that offer high transfer value, and courses that allow the program to pool rather than to duplicate the resources of high schools or college partners. During the course of my involvement with online college in the high school, I have been able to leverage the resources of numerous other funding sources to augment online college in the high school services and to enhance the experience for students. This includes federal Carl D. Perkins funds, the State of Minnesota Department of Health, and the Department of Department of Employment and Economic Development competitive grant funds. In addition, partnership in service has been established with the University of Minnesota's Area Health Education Center, the Initiative Fund, which serves our region, and numerous community-based businesses and employers. Online college in the high school has provided the students in the districts I serve extensive opportunities which previously did not exist. It offers rigorous course content and curriculum available to each and every individual student, regardless of where they live or what high school they attend. It offers college courses and college credit for high school students, complete with experiences in the college culture and system, such as understanding eligibility and placement processes, registration processes, timelines, deadlines, transcripts, financial aid implications, and transferability. It provides an opportunity to learn through and with technology, which may best meet the learning style of some students. And most importantly, it offers course content, subject matter, and topics which simply do not exist at our high school levels. And I'm really focusing on some of our technical areas, such as medical terminology, HTML, human anatomy and physiology, marketing and bioscience, and the general education areas such as philosophy, political science, sociology, personal finance, and economics. These experiences are all crucial to the comprehensive career development of students. It is exciting for me, with each term of online college in the high school, to be able to monitor and observe the students involved. I am thrilled and delighted with their success rates, their completion rates, and the rate of return to online college in the high school. But even more rewarding to me is to see the system change that online college in the high school is bringing to my high schools and to their students and teachers and parents. And that is one where a love of learning is fostered, encouraged, met, and sent forth. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those eloquent comments. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, when students sign up for these courses, do they often set aside a block of time in their high school schedule then where they either gather in one building or Do they go to the library and work on this, or do they take it all home and work on it? What's the usual pattern?
Ms. Abbott? Chair, Senator, our schools do this in a variety of different ways based on their building structures, their staffing patterns, but each high school does carve out time in the student's daily schedule for the student to work on his or her online course. Some of them have the students work on it in a media center. Some of the students actually go to a counseling office to work on their class. The high schools do allow them time in their daily schedule for working on their online classes, and then we stress that in addition to that, they will be spending time outside of their high school schedule to be successful in their online class.
Dean, can any Minnesota high school student take these courses, or only in the service area?
Madam Chair, any high school can participate.
Oh, they can.
In online college in the high school, yes.
Okay. Great. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. How is the college reimbursed by the districts? What is the amount that they pay, or how does that work out?
Ms. Wagner. We do run a business model with our online college in the high school. We sell seats in virtual classrooms, and so a district will, by enrolling a student, is purchasing a seat in that class. When we reach the drop add deadline for the term and we count up our students, then we do tuition bill our districts. And then actually it is the service co-op that I work at that actually ends up entering into the contract and paying the contracted tuition to our college partners.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And what approximately is that amount, and does it vary by course, or is it pretty standard rate?
Dean, I don't know who wants to answer.
Madam Chair.
Dean Abbott.
Madam Chair, Senator. Our contracted rate is different for a 2-credit, 3-credit, or 4-credit class. The contracted rate for a 3-credit class is $8,400, $8,432. And then we use a maximum estimate seat cost to let our high school partners know what they can budget for. That cost at the end is, of course, based on the overall enrollment in the program. And you do have a handout, a frequent answer handout, and we talk a little bit about that on page 2, item number 6. You can see what those maximum estimate seat costs are for each course.
Is it in here?
What handout are we talking about?
The one without the logo. It says online college in the high school frequent answers.
Okay. I think it was within the clipped section. Senator Weaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why do you need to have a partner?
What do you mean?
Why can't the service be provided directly as an option at the high school?
If there's
transferability in the Minscu system, and then it looks like in 2010 you're going to roll this out with the U of M, is this to get support, or...
Dean
to the extent
Abbott.
You want to share your business plan.
Madam Chair, Senator, philosophically, we view the partnership as a way to provide more of a safety net approach for both the students and our partner high schools. It has allowed us to get tangible and intangible support from a variety of sources to run the program in a quality way that we strive to run it. So it's more of a philosophical business model that we feel there's a value in the collaboration and the partnership.
Would homeschool students be eligible to participate?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions?
Madam Chair,
Senator
just
Weaker.
Briefly, it looks like the cost is less than what the credit would be at most colleges, and so isn't there a incentive to at least financially, to go towards your program if the academic outcomes would be similar?
Ms. Wagner.
Chair. Yes. There is an in-kind contribution and role from the high school, and that offsets some of that cost. We recognize that even though high school students may be intellectually capable of producing college-level work, developmentally, often they have other needs that need to be addressed to help them be successful. And that is really the expertise and the role of the K through 12 system, is to address the developmental needs of their high school learners. We have also tried to really outreach to students through online college in the high school with our safety net and proctor and local connection in their high school to students who maybe were not comfortable or did not feel that they were capable of college-level work. So with the proctor, they really do have a support person to help them take that first step. If they're having technical issues, to call the 800 number. If they need tutoring services, to go to online tutoring. Or if they have an issue with their faculty person, to talk to that person.
Thank you.
Well, this sounds like a great idea, and you have the system in place to respond to more high schools, because I'm sure the interest is going to be developing more in this area. Thank you both very much. Ms. Anderson, you gave quite a complete presentation earlier. Did you kind of complete your presentation, or did you have more that you were going to share with us? Okay. All right. Why don't you come forward then?
Madam Chair, committee members, we were asked to highlight interesting innovations or developments. I would like to highlight the PSEO online program at the University of Minnesota, Crookston. Michelle Christofferson, who is the director of that program, could not be here today, but I would certainly invite you to contact her for more details. I would just say a couple of things. One thing echoes what you just heard, that they found in order to ensure student success, they require each high school to have a staff facilitator person there. I would call them sort of a border collie. To make sure that the students get started, solve their technical problems, and are on task. That's really been important. Also, another thing that they have found, and it's very important to have term-based online courses, not just, you know, finish whenever kinds of courses. And as a measure of the demand, starting in fall 2006, there were more on-campus PSEO students, and now spring 2009, there are more than twice as many online students. So, and these courses are also available to all Minnesota students, and in fact, they work with students from all over. Then very briefly, in the multicolored packet that I brought, the green sheet gives you information about a new initiative at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities College in the Schools program. CIS in the Twin Cities has historically served students in the top 20% to 30%, but we know that more broader range of students need to go to college. So we are just in the process of launching what we call ECIS, the Entry Point Project. And that will be open to students in the 50th to 80th percentile of their high school. We have carefully selected the courses. We don't feel like it's doing anybody a favor to just open up all of our courses. We've selected courses that are really designed for additional practice. Students can have additional practice as part of the regular course. We are partnering with high schools that either have AVID in the high school or some other homegrown kind of academic support program. And we have now chosen the high schools that will be participating, and we will be launching the courses next fall.
And what are some of those high schools that are participating?
Oh, and knew you would ask that, so I wrote it down somewhere, and I have to. There is a St. Paul High School. There are charter high schools. And I cannot remember the others. I have not been involved in the selection process. But I can get those to you.
All right. Sounds great. All right. Thank you very much. Okay, for our last presentation, we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about getting students graduated in a timely manner with Bob McMasters and Sally Johnston. Are these separate presentations? Okay, so Mr. McMasters, that's okay. You can wait then. From the University of Minnesota.
I did bring a presentation that's over here on the side. I'm not sure if it was handed out to everybody.
We just got it.
Good. Okay. Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob McMaster. I'm the associate or the vice provost and dean of undergraduate education. And I wanted to provide just some brief notes on what we do at the university to get our students through in a timely way. We're hoping, of course, that's 4 years.
It's nice to hear you say that and not, we hope that is, of course, 6 years.
No. We assume
usually a four-year
graduation. We think the messaging is very important for students coming in the door and throughout their career at the University of Minnesota. And so we have provided students with a set of kind of recommendations of ideas on why it's important to graduate in 4 years. And that's on the first slide here. We think they're going to benefit from the greater intensity of their academic experience if they're there for only four. We feel there's going to be more intellectual coherence to the program. We think that students in 4 years are going to be more involved with the college or the university. We think students are going to be more competitive in seeking admission to graduate schools or professional schools if they get done in 4 years. And then we think that students, of course, are going to have a more or a better and more satisfying educational experience. As important as that is, the kind of philosophical reasons, there's also some very strong financial reasons. And in the messaging that goes out to students, especially over the last few years, we let them know the cost of graduating in 4 versus 6 years. In fact, we had our Carlson School of Management do some modeling for us on this. And to make a long story short, given the difference in both wages and in investment students would make over those 2 years, it's about $250,000 in lost wages if they have 2 extra years for graduation. So that's a pretty strong message, we think, to send to our students at that point. And we have lots of data to kind of back that up. We also think, we actually know that students who graduate in 6 years are obviously less likely to borrow as much money. And the next slide, which shows student debt load, kind of tracks through the percentage of students who will borrow in 4 years, in 5 years, and in 6 years. So in 4 years, 58.3% of the students will borrow to stay in school, whereas when you get out to 6 years, that's 70.6%. And you can see how the amount has gone up from about 21,000.
And that's really counterintuitive because you assume that students are taking longer to graduate because they're working more to pay for their education.
Right.
And it's so that they would have less of a debt load.
Exactly. It's absolutely counterintuitive.
And it's the opposite.
Right. So if you spend 6 years in addition to the lost wages, now you see you're going to be borrowing more money to stay at the university. So we think that's another important message for the students. We have some pretty solid strategies in place for both retention and graduation. Of course, we feel retention, a good first-year retention, leads to effective four-year graduation. So we have the new 13-credit registration rule that was put in place about a decade ago, and that's had a huge impact on
that's
student
minimum?
Behavior. Yeah, the tuition banding is so if you take 13 credits, you pay no more money. Yeah, it's the same amount from 1 to 13 credits.
Oh, I thought banding was you could take up to 17 credits and just pay for four.
Ours is 13, and then you start to get some additional charges beyond that. Yeah.
I guess I don't understand then how banding works.
The banding is that you pay one rate for 1 to 13 credits.
Well, 13, that won't even get you, that won't graduate you in time. Don't you need 15?
It won't actually, but most students, in fact, do take 14 or 15 or 16 credits a semester. So that's the way it works. But in fact, the banding itself is from 1 to 13.
You know, why did I think that banding was totally different, where you could 12 to you 17. Could take, I thought it was like 18 yeah. credits and only pay for 15.
It used to be.
Maybe I'm getting mixed up here on that. But certainly the effect of this has been a different behavior in student credit taking. It used to be students would pay differential rates, and then it was banded together. Maybe it is 17 or 18. I'm sorry. I should have that.
I'm sure it is, Senator Pappas.
Okay.
We actually did the legislation on that like a couple of years ago.
Okay.
All
good. Right. Continue.
Thank you.
We'll straighten that out later.
We also think that targeting financial aid to students most in need is a critical message that we send out here. We've had an increased emphasis on first-year programs, including orientation and Welcome Week. And at some point, we'll have to talk with you about Welcome Week because it's been an incredible success at the university. There's enhanced advising and earlier intervention. We feel interventions for students that are having trouble is really key. And then we're ramping up a whole set of programs for fiscal literacy for students and their parents, continued review of the curriculum and course scheduling. In fact, there's a major curricular review at the university that's going to be initiated in the next year or so, and then continued research on the factors that impact student success. I just wanted to mention one of the initiatives that we have ongoing at the university, and that's the freshman seminar program. It began as a pilot about a decade ago, and the impact on both retention and graduation has been significant. If you look at the table that's labeled freshman seminar, especially in the top right corner, one can see that the difference in the four-year graduation rate, and this would be for the class of 2003, the entering class of 2003, between those who take a seminar and those who don't is basically 42 to 51%. So these are the kinds of initiatives that are really critical to put in place to kind of engage the student in the academic and the social side of the university. In terms of retention, that's on the next slide. There's a whole set of retention initiatives.
You don't require all your freshmen to take the freshman seminar?
We do not. We don't have the resources in place right now. About 40% take freshman seminars at the moment, and we're hoping to ramp that up.
Do you, how is it decided which students will take the freshman seminar? Do they volunteer or?
Madam Chair, they self-select into the freshman seminars, yeah. So we've also found strong correlations with living on campus as freshmen, the student support programs that we have in place, the importance of gift and not loan support. We're developing a whole set of online tools for graduation and for staying on track. Access to courses for the degree plan. Of course, the tuition structure that encourages the full-time course loads that we just talked about. And then on-campus employment. And in particular, student employment related to the major drives up the graduation rate. So these are all positive indicators for four-year graduation. I wanted to mention one tool we have in place that's a graduation planner. That's something that was started about a year ago. It's an online tool so that students can lay out their entire program at once and run multiple scenarios or multiple models for their degree plans. So it's really an experimental tool where students can pick two or three majors and essentially schedule their whole set of classes over 4 years online. The graduation planner usage has gone way up from
Dean McMasters. Yes. Did you say they could actually schedule them or
Plan them.
Plan
their entire curriculum over the 4 years.
They don't necessarily know if they'll be able to get into the class.
They don't know if they can get into the class, but theoretically they know the class will be offered in that semester at that time. Yeah. And you can see that the growth in this has gone from 142% increase with the actual individual plans and 187% increase with the multiple plans. That is, students can create a couple plans. They don't have to do just one. Another one of our strategies is called the four-year graduation guarantee, and that's on the next slide. It was started in 1996. What this says is that if they do what they're told, if the undergraduates do what they're told, and I'll clue you in on what that is in a moment, they're guaranteed that if they have to take an extra course to graduate, the university will pay for that course. So in May, the students are sent a brochure and letter explaining this particular program. there's a quote from the brochure that explains to students exactly what this four-year guarantee is. And then the message to students is be prepared to plan and graduate in 4 years. Complete the freshman writing requirement in the first year. That's really key. Get the writing requirements out of the way. Work with advisors to develop the plan. Meet checkpoints for the major along the way. Remain in good standing. That seems pretty obvious. Apply for graduation by the appropriate deadline. And make timely annual application for all necessary financial aid. I should mention there are a few degree programs that aren't eligible for this, given the complexity of the curriculum in certain courses that if a student misses, can't be repeated for a year or two.
Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McMasters, has any student ever made a claim or challenged the guarantee?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Weaver, that's a great question. No, we haven't paid $1 out to students who haven't been able to fulfill the guarantee. In the four-year guarantee, if a student doesn't get into a required course, they submit a form to our office. Our office works with the department to get them in the course either that semester or the next semester, or we waive the course working with the department. And if none of these are possible, we find a spot for that student in a subsequent semester. So we think that that's a good message to send to the students, that in fact we will guarantee, based on the curricular needs, we can get them out of the university on time.
And so, this, Dean McMasters, yeah. One thing you didn't include in here, it started in 1996, so about 13 years, 12 years. How many students have participated then, have used this as an option to graduate in 4 years?
About 90% of the students sign up for the graduation guarantee each year. Uh-huh. And we've just shifted over the last few years from a paper to an online version.
So the fact that, though, how has that influenced the graduation rate then, and have you seen any improvement, and why are students not graduating in 4 years if 90% of them sign up for the 4 years?
Madam Chair, they aren't graduating in 4 years because they don't follow the guidelines that we put in place. So, for instance, if they switch a major, then they run into trouble. Yeah.
Senator Pappas? Senator Sharon?
When you're talking about the positive effects on retention, what the assets are that create a positive effect on retention, were you able to determine which of these had a greater or lesser impact, which were weighted higher than others?
Senator Sharon, we haven't really run a multivariate analysis to kind of figure out which are contributing most of the variance to the graduation rate, but certainly we know that student employment is one of the actual major contributors. If a student works a bit, about 10 or so hours a week on campus, it makes a huge difference in the graduation rate. We also found, in particular for first-year retention, a critical issue is whether they live in the dorms, live on campus or not, and that's made a significant difference as well. So I can't tease out and give you the actual contribution for each one of these, but we know which ones are sort of more important than the others.
Senator Weaver.
Madam Chair, Dean McMasters, with post-secondary options, dual credit, and summer sessions, banded credits, there must be a growing number graduating in less than 4 years as well. Do you have any statistic on that?
Yeah, so Madam Chair, Senator Weaver, again, we have some anecdotal information. There are certain colleges in particular where students are graduating in less than 4 years. The College of Biological Sciences is one of those. Because of the nature of their curriculum and the very strong advising students have in CBS, they're seeing a percentage. It's not a large percentage, maybe 1 to 5 that are graduating in less than 4 years, which is great news because that counterbalances the others. Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dean McMasters, I plan to ask this question to Sally Johnson, who's going to follow you as well. But can you summarize your understanding of what the explanation has been over the last number of years of why the graduation rate has slowed? We hear back home all sorts of explanations given to us, and if we're, you know, to deal with those here, I'd really like to get a better understanding. Some of the things our constituents say are, well, they can't get into required courses, or the cost of tuition is so high that they have to work more, which means they carry, reduced work, school credit load, and all those sorts of things. And the causations are different and coming from different places. So if we're going to be dealing with how to tighten up a graduation rate, we have to address different causative factors. And what do you see?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, let me give you two answers to that. One is in terms of the graduation rate this year, which slowed down a bit. It turns out that it was a bad retention year about 3 years ago that caused that. So if you have a bad retention year, freshman to sophomore, that propagates through the system and kind of follows through. And so we saw that happening. Another example is within one of the colleges, some of the students were having trouble with some of the key courses. And it turns out it was a mathematics course. And so a large number of students were getting tripped up by a certain course, which slowed the graduation rate because they had to retake that course in that particular college. I think you hit on a major issue here, which is the curriculum. That is, some of the majors are, in fact, oversubscribed in terms of credits, and we're starting to look very carefully now at those majors with some recommendations for how they can be streamlined so that students really can get out with 120 credits, not with 130 or 140 or even, in certain cases, 150 credits.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you. One more follow-up. Back to the trouble with the key courses, and I think you suggested a little bit of this. I want to confirm. So the students were having trouble with the content of the classes, not accessibility of the classes.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. Okay. In my office has a very strong program of making sure students get into the classes they need, and so very few students can't get into the classes. But we can't do a great deal in certain cases about the content and the actual success rate in those classes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And then we'd like to welcome, thank you, Sally Johnstone from Winona State. Welcome, and
thank
nice
you.
To see you.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come up here today. I'm Sally Johnstone, the Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Winona State University. And I've brought with me a couple of colleagues in case you have questions for them. The first one is Cassandra Olzeltson, who is one of our senior nursing students and is graduating with one of our four-year guarantee program. And she was originally from Marshfield, Wisconsin.
Why don't you come and join her at the table?
Great, great. And she agreed to give up her clinicals today and is working with her faculty member in her placement area to join us, but she may be able to offer some insight into what a four-year guarantee means to a student. And also our dean of our College of Liberal Arts, Dr. Peter Henderson, who has been at Winona State for many years and has watched what goes on with some changes in the way that we've done things. We
Great.
Do have a four-year degree program, and that was what I was asked to come and help you understand. It is not radically dissimilar from what we just heard at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. If a student signs up for the guarantee, follows the framework of the guarantee, and complies with it, we promise they'll be out in 4 years or we pick up the cost. And again, anticipating a question, I asked around, and at least for the last decade, we've never been asked to pay for extra courses. Naturally, the students that sign up for this are highly motivated. And as we look at where our greatest engagement is in that, I think it makes sense. They have to meet with their academic advisors each term and review what they're doing and pay very close attention to their pathway through their college career. We began this in 1984, and it started in our College of Science and Engineering, and the goal, again, was to help very highly motivated and well-prepared students have a track that they could follow so that they knew what they needed to do, and if they did it, that they would know they could be successful. It's also offered in several of our liberal arts programs, things like criminal justice, sociology, theater, dance, social work, political science, and a few of our areas in the College of Business, Economics, and Marketing. But the greatest use of this program, which is probably not a surprise, is in our College of Nursing and in our engineering program. In our College of Nursing, which is a very competitive program, students come in, work for 2 years on a fairly proscribed undergraduate program, and then are admitted into the college in their junior year. This year, we have 453 pre-nursing students who have signed the four-year guarantee. It's a stringent program. Not all of them we know will be successful, but this year we are graduating 100 of our four-year guarantee nurses, and Cassandra is one of them. In engineering, this fall, we had 29 freshmen signed contracts, and this May, we'll have three graduating under the four-year guarantee. One of the tough things about the guarantee is that you can't change your mind, and we just heard that. One of the reasons that students are not successful frequently in a four-year program is they do change their minds. If they come in and they know they want to be an engineer, they know they want to go into nursing, they're focused. They tend to move in that direction. But we have, I believe it's between 60 and 70% of our students that come to Winona State, before they graduate, they've changed their major. Mm-hmm. They come in thinking they want to have a degree in political science, take a few courses in other areas, and discover, no, they really wanted to be in social work. Mm-hmm. Well, that means not that they've wasted their time, but the time they've invested in the preliminary courses in one major aren't going to count in quite the same way as they move into another major. And I know that that's a tough thing, but I'm not sure it's always a bad thing, because I'm not sure that students that come into a liberal arts environment need to be forced to say, this is what I'm doing and this is all I will do.
I think the problem is just the expense for the system and the expense for the student. If we could get them to do that kind of course and career exploration when they're a senior in high school, which is, there's a lot of capacity there for doing more than the senior slide students do now.
And Madam
Chair, perhaps it would help them make those decisions a little earlier.
I would agree with you, but I would also agree with some of the other individuals who have testified that not all students or not all human beings at age 17 or 18 have sufficient maturity to completely understand where they want to go and how they want to do it. I do know that in other states they have put limits on the number of credits that a student can earn and still be considered an in-state student regardless of where they're from. Arizona's done that. California's done
it. We only allow financial aid for 4 years.
That's exactly. And it's a way of a wake-up call to students and their families. But I'm not sure this is a problem anyone can completely solve. The cost issue is very real, though. We have also tried to do a lot to keep our students on track for 4 years. Because I'm the chief academic officer, I pay a lot of attention to the academics, so we are intervening in areas that we know students are having difficulty with. Mathematics is top one around the country. The next is writing and language. We've taken on mathematics in the last couple of years and actually pinpointed where the issues are and have introduced programs to try and help that work. And I'm waiting for data. I'd hope to have it to share today. Don't have it yet. But the early indicators are that our in following what's going on in the rest of the nation around intervention with mathematics and helping students be successful, it keeps them on track, and we are seeing greater persistence, which is, of course, the strongest indicator to success within the time frame that we're aiming for, which is 4 years.
At Winona State, you have entrance requirements.
We do.
Right. Do you also offer a summer bridge program for students who you've accepted but maybe aren't quite ready?
We have the summer bridge programs that we offer, and the intensive intervention programs we offer are usually around first-time college goers in their family and students in minority categories. So we've focused our efforts in those areas to assure success because those are the most vulnerable students we have. We don't offer it across the board. It would be nice if we could. And get students to do it. But after their senior year, they're usually working anyway, as I think all of us recognize. We've also tried very hard to accommodate access to the classes that are necessary. And that's been a major effort in the last 3 years at Winona State. And as Dean Henderson can attest, our registration process is very intensive, watching very carefully of making sure there are courses available for freshmen and sophomores as they're registering so that we can get them moving. That is also one of the things in terms of access to classes and being able to afford to have sufficient fixed term or adjunct faculty that we can put in when we need extra sections. As you all know, is a tough thing to do in tight budget times. So it's an area we're looking at closely and trying very hard to accommodate, and we'll have to make decisions around that. That will be tough.
Cassandra, what was your last name again?
Hazelton.
Could you just tell us what the advantage you have found with the four-year guarantee?
Madam Senator, I think that it has been very, when I looked for colleges, I found it very appealing to know that when I was looking at Winona State, they offered a four-year guarantee. Not only did I just find out today that I saved myself $250,000, my parents will be very proud, and I'll relay that message to them. I think that it has been very a unique experience that has kept my focus, and the advantage to it would be that going in, I know that I needed to follow a certain criteria to succeed. And with my colleagues, there's a class of 50 that I follow. And we all know that we need to stay on course and stay on task to achieve what we need. And with the advisors that we have and the structure that we have been provided, it's been quite easy to stay on task with the motivation that we all have.
Great, thanks. Dean Henderson, did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, Senators, one response to a question that you raised earlier. Another reason that many students do not follow a four-year prescribed program is parental influence. And I've noticed a lot of our students who come to Winona State, their parents would like them to enroll in one of the professional programs like Cassandra did. However, after a year or two at Winona State, they decide they really love political science or their interests have changed radically. And so this is a reason why they do shift majors. And those numbers are very high, 60 or 70%.
Senator Erickson-Robson, do you want to ask Ms. Johnston a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we're talking about some of those shifts, major shifts, also might contribute to putting students off the four-year track. But if you could respond to the same question I asked the dean, having to do with, from your perspective, what are some of the causative factors that that cause this separation away from the four-year goal?
The largest one by thank you, Madam Chair. The largest one is by far the changing of majors, discovering themselves, understanding interests that they didn't know they had. Because when you're in high school, you're not exposed to the same realm of possibilities. But beyond that, indeed, students are working more. We know that when we look at the numbers. And that does make it harder, even though we have banded tuition, which helps. so that if a student...
How does your banded tuition
work? Our banded tuition works so that if you are a full-time student taking at least 12 hours of credit, you can take up to 18 hours of credit for no additional cost. And then there's a small cost over that. So if you take 19, and we do have students that do more than that, but by and large, we're looking at that as the range. And if you're working off campus, or you have to take a term off, which happens, as we all know, does occur, it's tough to keep up that level of work and to keep it up at a rate that allows you to continue to be successful. One issue that has come up that I think is a new one, and I think it's very interesting. I was talking to a group of seniors recently as they are getting ready to graduate and look at things, and they are not in a nursing program. And they're kind of going, I don't know why I'm bothering to graduate. All I'm going to do is go home and live with my folks. There's no job for me. Mm-hmm. So they're prolonging. That's what I'm hearing. Now, I don't know, but I've heard there's no reason for me not to take another term. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's, you know,
more productively, though, would be if they went to grad school. Yeah. If they graduated and went to grad school.
Absolutely. But I was fascinated. I mean, this.
Or they graduated and went to technical school and got a nursing degree.
Right, right. But I had never heard this before until just this moment in time.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, yes, in response to that, I think that should give us pause here at the Capitol or anyone else who looks at graduation rates, the number of years attending at a particular universities, and stop for a second before we judge too quickly. Oh, this college seems to have a really slow rate here, and this one graduates 4 years or 5 years. I mean, there's a lot of factors that are beyond the control of the universities and the colleges as to why their students may travel through their system at particular rates. So, which is underneath my question about causation, because if there's something that the universities can be doing to, you know, make sure that students are moving along as quickly as possible, that's one thing. But if we have causative factors like changing their majors, I mean, we might have to deal with some kind of introductory sorts of opportunities for students. But if they decide to take a term off for family reasons or, I mean, whatever the mix is, or the economy is bad, may as well take another couple classes. These are reasons, you know, that we should really be careful about judging universities and holding them accountable for slow graduation rates.
Well, something I would like to know, and at a later time, because I don't know if we can address it right now, is why the private colleges seem to have a better four-year graduation rate than the public colleges. And because certainly students who go to private college also might decide to change their majors, or maybe not. No, I mean, I really don't know. So your short answer to that is?
The short answer is that private colleges are quite diverse, as are public institutions quite diverse. And by and large, our public institutions offer greater variety and opportunity to students than private colleges in general, because they tend to be more focused. So a student will come into a college in a more focused environment and move through it.
So the student chooses that college for that reason, because it's more focused, and they tend to be more focused then.
Or he or she may be much, is differently motivated, let's put it that way.
And maybe they can't go back to their parents and say, you have to spend another year of $20,000 tuition. Okay, well, I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I've really enjoyed the hearing, and thank you everyone for attending. Meeting
thank
is
you.
Adjourned.